It's 8:13. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, at its meeting last week, the Park City Board of Education approved tunnel option A1 to go under Highway 248 between the LDS Seminary and Park City High School. I'm on the phone to talk to us about that as well as some of the other issues. I have School District Communications Director Melinda Colton. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So as we've talked, the agreement said this was for a tunnel basically already built at Comstock. So we just used the old agreement and then didn't change out the details?
I think what they did is ended up just giving the board a sample, the city did, of kind of what they're looking for, similar to what we did last time. So I was new. I didn't quite all understand that, but I think we have it figured out now. As you said, that it's going to replace that signal crosswalk from the high school over across to the seminary building.
So what we've got now is that crosswalk with a hawk beacon signal. Does that go away entirely once this is built?
It's my understanding, yes, that they want people to use that tunnel mostly for safety reasons.
Yeah.
Also traffic reasons.
Right. Yeah, because that's what a city transportation, I think, told the board. Average use on that hawk beacon is 5 to 15 times an hour. So that could have a significant impact then on the backups.
Well, it's not just students that are using it, too. You've got lots of those housing units over there, people that are coming to catch the bus, all that kind of stuff that's right there near the high school. So it will be utilized by not just our students, but year-round throughout the community.
And I guess that's a concern, I think, by some of the residents there and maybe those turning left out of the high school, that Hawk Beacon has kind of given them a break in traffic to be able to do that. So do we have thoughts about how they're going to get out of the school or out of their houses?
Well, and I think as this comes under, I think construction is going to be a difficult time too along SR 248 as they're building this underneath there. I think it's something that the city does have some additional plans that they'll look at. They have done a complete traffic study, so I'm sure that's all included in their proposal as we get a little bit closer to this.
Okay, well, I'll make sure.
This 1A option that they selected, Leslie, I think was really more about aesthetics that the board, they liked it. It had the most pros of the three options that were presented, and it really provided this direct path for most of those who will be using it. So as we progress, again, they're not going to start construction until probably spring 2019. So we've got a little bit of time, and they'll have to do additional studies with that to see how that impacts how kids are getting out of the high school parking lot.
So it will be similar to what we see at Comstock. So there's a way for bikes or strollers to get down as well as stairs?
Correct. And there will be security cameras. It will be heated during those winter months so that it's not icy and those kinds of things. So very similar. We've had a great partnership with Park City Municipal, and so they're making sure that they put everything into it that we have in our last one that's working quite efficiently.
Yeah, what's the timing on this?
Well, again, spring 2019 is really when they're going to commence construction. So now they begin looking at all of the different plans. They've got to set out RFPs. All of those different things will go on between now and spring. And then I would anticipate that it would be done, I'm hopeful, by the start of our 19-20 school year.
All right. And then in terms of cost, how much is it?
I don't know the cost of that. The city is the one who's handling that, so I don't believe that we have received a cost on that. They're the ones that will be handling the majority of all of the money for it.
And what's Park City School District's contribution towards this?
Well, what we will do is allow them to have easements and those kinds of things that will be necessary as the construction gets going. We're very concerned, as the city is aware, of not losing any parking. And so with actually all of these options, they did a tremendous job when they designed these to look at the fact that we wouldn't lose any different options. What we might lose near the tunnel, we would make up in other areas. So our contribution really is just, I think, being a good partner and allowing them access to our land, and they're covering the cost of it, is my understanding.
Okay, what about the LDS Church? Is that...
No, they won't be doing anything as well. All the city.
Okay. Let's see. Let's talk a little bit about the Kilby Road project. That is well underway, if people notice that going on there in front of Ecker Hill Middle School. There was a presentation at last board meeting by Summit County Public Works Director Derek Gradke showing the layout of the new roundabouts and the new tunnel there connecting the park and ride lot with Ecker Hill Middle School. So why are we connecting these two locations?
Because as they're looking at the new improvements that will be made along that road, there's going to have to be some kind of a tunnel, even with the traffic, so that students have a safer way. Rather than actually crossing Kilby Road, it's going to become kind of like an SR 248, where traffic will increase. And so they want to have a safe way for students to be able to get from that park and ride, where parents will be able to drop their students off, and then to go into the tunnel, and it will have all the same security measures that we are anticipating in Park City as well, with cameras, and the feeds will go into the school so that we can maintain safety and those kinds of things along there.
Okay, so that will become the new drop-off and pick-up location?
Not necessarily. It will become one of the park. The park and ride, what the, Derek said they would be doing was allowing anywhere from 10 to 15 spaces right there in the very front of the lot closest to the school that parents could do. That could be one drop-off, because if anyone's been out there during drop-off and pick-ups, it's quite a line. So they still will be able to do the usual route they always have, but it may be easier for parents to be able to just drop off and know that their kids will safely go into the tunnel into the school.
Yeah, well,
and that is supposed to be done by August 23rd when classes start. So they're making incredible progress, I think, on that park and ride this summer.
So will it also be a way for those using the park and ride to catch a bus?
I believe so, yes. They'll catch a bus to wherever their certain destinations are.
All right.
Oh, you mean our school buses?
No. Just anybody.
Oh, you meant buses.
Somebody who's
general.
Parking there and wanted to get a bus to the transit center.
Correct, yes. That's going to be the beauty of it. You know, and I think a lot of people with the roundabouts and those things that are happening, Leslie, it's going to be kind of a new way of driving. So it's going to take people a while to get used to. But from what the county is telling us, it's going to be a tremendous asset out there on Kilby Road and help with the traffic. It's just a lot of growing pains right now as this construction's going on.
Yeah. Is there a way to see the project online anywhere?
I believe they can contact Summit County. They have that information.
Okay.
He brought printed copies to the meeting, so we don't actually have those online right now. But if they would contact the Public Works Department at the county, they could certainly provide those.
All right. Let's see. The final school board of the meeting until August, at least the budget adoption scheduled for next Tuesday, July 3rd, a day before the holiday. Last chance for people to give public input. I guess I'm really curious because you reported that the school board adopted the revised current year budget as well as next year's tentative budget at last week's meeting. So why are we having another meeting to do the same thing?
If you recall the meeting that we had where we didn't have a quorum and we only had two board members there. We did have one patron who came and offered comment, but because they couldn't do anything with the budget and then we quickly did it just a few days around, the board did approve it on the 21st because they have a state mandate where all school district budgets have to be adopted by June 22nd. So they did adopt it, but they want to give the public enough time now, and even though it's a day before a holiday, they wanted to give this extra time for people to go ahead and look at the budget. People can look at the budget in detail on our website, pcschools.us/budget. They can get to both those budgets and look at them. And then on July 3rd, again, they want to have another hearing so that the public can go ahead and comment if they still would like to. Then what we will do on July 3rd is formally ratify it.
Okay, so it's been approved, but we're going to go back and take public comment on it. So, I mean, really, could any changes be made? It's a done deal.
It could. If they get enough public comment and they feel like something has swayed them, then definitely. We did have board member Petra Butler did dissent on the budget. And so, you know, people may have some of the concerns she had, which centered around with the additional personnel that we're hiring. She just really has concerns about how we're going to orient them, how we're going to onboard them and make sure that we are doing the job that they've been hired to do. Our educators, Leslie, are famous for coming in and not only doing their jobs, but other as assigned duties, and those roles tend to evolve. So she wants to make sure, and we have the commitment of our incoming superintendent to make sure that these positions are indeed given the proper orientation they need so that they can be set up for success in these jobs.
All right. Well, she was certainly outvoted, I think, what, 4-1,
3-1? Yes.
Yeah, so it really doesn't matter. What kind of staff is working on this though? Then to bring this many new people up to speed?
Well, our interim superintendent, David Gomez, is really spending the summer looking at those kinds of things. He's establishing a schedule right now of all of the different portions that these new employees coming in need to be aware of. And so he will then present that over to the superintendent, and she will be responsible for making sure that gets implemented. And I think it's a great idea. I think that Board Member Butler has those concerns, as does the rest of the board, and they want some guarantees and some accountability that that's going to happen. So Mr. Gomez is busy putting that together and working not only at his own school, but still as the interim superintendent, trying to get everything ready and in order before Dr. Gilday starts in August.
Yeah, and we have, of course, a new high school principal and the new superintendent. Are they involved in any of these hiring decisions, or at least seeing the resumes?
Oh, yes. Especially at the high school, you know, we just hired a secondary assistant principal there, and we'll be announcing those names shortly. He was very involved in that process and making sure that he had a team that would be, you know, kind of gel with him. And he will also make sure that that person coming in, as well as the other two assistant principals, are all in line with what they should be doing and the division of responsibilities.
Okay, and something we heard just last week is that we've got $1 million targeted from the capital budget to purchase a home of which the new superintendent will live in. It'll be a home for all future superintendents. Mm-hmm. Has the district found that house?
No. In fact, I don't know that the superintendent has made up her mind if that's the route she wants to go or not. That's something she's going to want to look into. She may get here and decide that she wants to purchase a home as a great investment. That's an option that is available to her, but not one necessarily that she has to take. So it's one of those things that I think the board is just kind of waiting for her to get here. I do believe that Todd Hauber is working with her at looking at some different kind of home opportunities, but ultimately that decision is going to be hers and whether or not she takes that benefit.
So would the district still go ahead and purchase a home?
If she decides that she doesn't want the home, it's my understanding that that's not something that we would do at this time, but we would continue looking to see when we can get the best kind of a deal. Housing is just continuing to get more expensive and more expensive, and that may be something that the board during the coming year looks at as to when would be the best time to purchase one. And if that's something that she isn't going to need for a while, then we've got a little bit of time to wait for the housing market to slow down a little.
So is Todd Hauber the district's realtor, or do you need to do an RFP to choose one to make this happen if, in fact, that's what you go through with?
I think ultimately when we get going on that and get a little closer, I believe that Mr. Hauber is, you know, intimately involved in that. But as to what his role in the final decision will be, I'm not sure. I would think that we had worked through some kind of a real estate agent to make sure that we get the best opportunity and the best location and all those things for a future superintendent. But again, there's no point in buying it if that's not something that the superintendent wants right now.
All right. Next Tuesday's meeting again, when and where?
July 3rd, that is Tuesday at 6 p.m., and we take public comment right at the start of the meeting. So I would strongly encourage people to look at the budget, to go through it, again, on the website, pcschools.us, and then just put a slash and budget to review that, because the last thing we want is people getting their tax notices and going, wow, I didn't know about this. So the board really wants to be transparent. They want people to know what it is that they're approving, and they do sincerely welcome comment on this budget.
Anything else you wanted to mention, Melinda?
Oh, it's a busy summer. We're trying to all get things done and ready and going so that we're ready for Dr. Gilday when she gets here, and more importantly, that we're ready when classes start on the 23rd of August.
All right. Thanks for your time this morning.
Okay. Thank you, Leslie.
It's Melinda Colton, Park City School District Communications Director. News. It's 8:28. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, in order to clear the schedule for next week's holiday, the Park City Council held a special meeting yesterday. In the studio with a recap of some of those items discussed, I have Council Member Nan Worrell. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's see. Summit County Council members looking for the City Council's thoughts about the local option sales tax for transit and transportation. Any consensus from the City Council?
We really appreciated them coming in and helping us understand what it was that they were what was being proposed and what they're struggling with and what they're going to be talking about at their meeting this afternoon. our concern is with the timing of it. I mean, it's a difficult timing. They acknowledge that it is. People, the school board is going to be coming forward, I believe, with another tax. We have a bond that's going to be coming on. At some point, enough is enough. And, you know, so that's our main concern is what is it going to do to the community?
Yeah. Well, and we should also talk, just to be fair, that some of the higher taxes have come from Park City Municipal itself. Of
Absolutely.
Course, the 1% municipal TRT, transit room tax, the 1% open space and capital
right.
projects. And, of course, now the possibility of the treasure tax increase. Is that the concern here, though, that this additional transit taxes could make the treasure tax increase a tougher sell?
I think that's part of the concern, and I think we're also hearing tax fatigue from people. We're hearing that loud and clear. And from what I understand and what I appreciate about this particular tax is it does not apply to groceries or gas. So for our lower-income individuals, it's not going to impact, you know, their ability to continue, you know, buying groceries and that type of thing. From what we understand, too, it's only going to add about $45 a year to each individual. That's not a tipping point for most folks, but you worry about, again, the lower income folks in our community that is going to impact.
So was there any direction then to the county council? You're just like, you guys figure it out? Or
they weren't asking for our direction. They were just asking for our thoughts, and we shared them with them.
All right. As county council member Roger Armstrong noted, the tax could be repealed. So if not, why not just go ahead and at least get that first year's collection?
Part of our concern was that the other big counties, like Salt Lake County, is kind of iffy on whether or not they're going to adopt this. From what I understand, Utah and Washington County still haven't weighed in on whether they are or not. And so one of the concerns that was expressed by our council is, you know, yes, we get all the funds for the first year, but if those counties don't buy in, then with equalization, are we sending our tax money down into those other counties? And so would it be better to wait until we find out what those counties are doing before Summit County moves forward with what they're doing? That was one of the concerns.
And certainly the city's argument on any tax is always, well, you know, it's the second homeowners and businesses that pay for it, not primary residents. So, I mean, we're not using that excuse this time?
Well, it's a sales tax. You know, it's an increase in the sales tax. So it does apply to all of us. It's not just the second homeowners. It's not just the visitors. It applies to all of us.
What is that breakdown in terms of, do we know, in terms of what the visitors pay in sales tax as opposed to the
I'm sorry,
residents?
I don't know that off the top of my head.
You also had an update from the Recreation Advisory Board visioning report. Council basically said move forward with terms in terms of researching Wi-Fi for City Park, lighting for the volleyball courts, protecting several parks with not necessarily a conservation easement, but something that would make it difficult to just sell, building a splash pad, and then donations for people to memorialize a loved one. It was basically a yes on all of their wish lists.
There was a lot of discussion about many of those items. We did want them to move forward with investigating what other protections can be put on our parks so that it wouldn't just be if somebody decided or the city decided they wanted to put housing on one of our parks, you know, then that would require a ref to go to the voters to have everyone weigh in and take it to a vote. So it's just one more level of protection that they're suggesting, and they wanted to just have the green light to go ahead and continue some research on that, on how that might look and go forward. The Recreation Advisory Board had gone down and visited a huge splash pad down in the valley and came back really excited about perhaps that might be something that would be nice here. So they were just asking for the green light to go ahead and continue to investigate that with, you know, where possible locations could be, what costs might be involved. In terms of free Wi-Fi in City Park, yes, they were given the go-ahead to continue to investigate that, but, you know, no decisions were made in
yep.
regard to that.
And as we've talked, you know, about trying to save money, I mean, I don't recall who said it, but, you know, the city's looking under their couches for a spare change and looking under my couch, too, for that spare change.
Right.
So as we look for ways to be austere, to plan ahead and to cut the budget, I mean, here we've got lighting, Wi-Fi, splash pad. I mean, aren't those, don't we start there looking at ways to
actually
make cuts?
I didn't mention the lighting proposal. Council felt like we have been kind of putting off redoing lights down at Quinn's Junction. There's been a lot of concerns by neighbors and people coming in on the, 248 about the brightness of those lights and the amount of time that they're on. And the staff, when we talked about it last time, said that the technology just wasn't quite right at this point in time. And so that came up last night. And why, if we're going to postpone the Quinn's project, are we going to go ahead and put more lights here at City Park? And so we decided that it would be best to wait to pursue that option until we could do both and maybe get some cost savings in that way.
Staff told council that the splash pad would help with the council's critical priority of social equity. And then Councilmember Becca Gerber joked that now all staff would say their project focuses on social equity. So just to be sure, I mean, will there be some kind of checklist to ensure that, you know, when people come in with a social equity project, that it indeed it is?
We haven't talked about that, but that's a good idea.
All right. Let's see. You also had Kilo Zamora come in to give a presentation about implicit bias with the social equity talk. He never really got a chance to speak on that, I guess. He had reported the findings of meetings with some focus groups. I believe that you also attended on Monday. So Councilmember Tim Henney said he feels as though people keep saying what the city should do. He thinks the community should take it on, not the city. So do you agree with that? What's the city's role here?
He was responding to the initial minutes that came out from those social equity focus groups that we did on Monday, and we did three. We did one with nonprofit leaders. We did one with city staff from different departments that are very involved with this issue. And then we did one of other, a more diverse community, representatives from different groups that oftentimes feel marginalized, like our seniors, like our teens, like the Gay Straight Alliance from the school, the arts district. You know, so, I mean, they were great discussions. We looked across the board for, did the community buy into this? And we heard loud and clear from these groups that, yes, indeed, they did. And so the next step was, one of the questions was, what can the city do to help move this along or help you with your efforts? I'm kind of paraphrasing here. And so the responses that we saw initially, that Tim saw initially, were, well, this is some things that would be helpful from the city. But it was an elicited question. It wasn't them saying, well, you need to be doing this. There's very much enthusiasm among those groups. They appreciated the city taking a role in convening, and they want to collaborate. They want to work together to make this happen because it is a community issue. It's not just something the city should own. It's not something that one nonprofit should own. It's all of us it's going to take.
Okay. And then in terms of, I mean, the city's role, is it as facilitator? Is it as financer?
We're still defining that. Right now we're convening and we're bringing together groups. One of the things that we talked about last night, one concern that I had after attending the focus groups, and by the way, I came away really energized by the amount of enthusiasm and energy in the rooms, was that it's now time to be talking about talking to folks on the street, people that both think that this is something that we need very much, that would be helpful to them individually, whether that means that they're, you know, one of our lower income workers or our middle income workers in town. How can this benefit them? What do they need instead of us sitting here and saying this is exactly what you need? Our nonprofits are in an amazing position because every one of those executive directors is totally engaged with the people that they serve and they have a good understanding of the needs. But we'd like to hear from those folks as well.
Yeah. And I think, as Mr. Zamora said, a window has been opened. The community is on board, but time is of the essence. And I guess that he said that you need to act quickly or we lose this. So what happens from here?
We are going to put together an RFP that we'll be looking at again on July 12th for someone to come, whether that's an agency or an individual, to take on this convening process so that we can come forward with some next steps. We need to keep bringing these groups together. We need to keep expanding that circle, bringing more and more voices to the table here. So right now we're kind of more of in a convener role.
All right. Council also wants staff, I wanted to move on to the discussion of the locally preferred alternative for State Road 224. The county seems to be on board with this locally preferred option as well. So everyone's agreeing that this is the right plan to move forward with?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And that was what the resolution was last night. They really looked at lots and lots and lots of different options. And this one made the most sense in terms of getting single occupancy vehicles off the road and making it easier for people to get onto transit, dedicating bus lanes.
And when we talk about, you know, the future of transportation, how far out are we looking? And the reason I ask is because I asked City Manager Diane Foster about, are we precluding the opportunity to put light rail in, which kind of goes down the center of streets. And she basically said, you know, light rail isn't coming to Park City anytime soon. But I guess, again, as we look into the future, how far are we looking?
Well, they were looking at all the way up to 2040, 2050. And right now we have about 30,000 cars a day on 224. And it's projected that by 2040, we're going to have about 44,000 cars a day on 224. So they looked at a lot of different options, light rail being one of them, but there really wasn't the demand to justify the cost to be able to do that at this point in time.
So in 2040, we're saying we'll still have 44,000 cars, even with all of the work we're doing?
If we don't do all that work, we're definitely going to be there. Hopefully, by doing that work, we're going to cut that down significantly.
All right. Let's see, anything else you wanted to mention, Ann?
Absolutely. I wanted to make people aware that there's going to be intermittent MyStop service today, and the MyStop app that tells you when your bus is going to be coming may be offline on and off today due to system upgrades. All buses are going to be running according to their published schedules, and for more information and to help plan trips, you can visit Google Transit. Type in your location and destination, and they'll give you route options. You can go to parkcitytransit.org or the transit centers to find out schedules. You can call the transit office at 435-615-5353, and they will give you some information about bus availability. And you can also ask your driver. They'll be happy to help you with that. I also wanted to mention that a couple of weeks ago, we micro-surfaced, it's hard to say, Main Street with a new slurry seal. And we've heard feedback that some residents are concerned that we resurfaced over brick.
Have you heard that? Because I've heard a couple people ask me about it.
Absolutely. Okay. We've heard that a lot. In fact, when somebody first asked me, I thought, oh my gosh, were there brick sidewalks there? Because I couldn't remember. It just
me either.
Like, just seemed like there were. In fact, there were never brick sidewalks on Main Street. They've all been on Sweet Alley. And so all traditionally all along, and now all the crosswalks were painted on, and we'll continue that way.
Okay.
And just want to wish everybody a happy 4th of July.
All right. Thanks for coming in, Nan.
Thank you.
It's 8:43. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, as we reported, Utah Open Lands has kicked off a $6 million campaign to save the Snow Ranch pastures. On the phone with details, I have the executive director of Utah Open Lands, Wendy Fisher. Good morning, Wendy.
Good morning, Leslie.
This is a 19-acre parcel of property owned by the Armstrong family. Does it have vested zoning attached to it?
It does. It is actually within the third-acre zoning that, of course, Olive Fiennes Canyon development is in.
Okay. So even though there's no approved development plan for it, it does have that underlying zoning that could have, I guess, what, 19 times 3 units, huh?
Yeah, and I think the thing about it that we look at is, of course, a lot of people thought that this was in the county, but this part of the property is definitely in the city with that zoning.
All right. So this is the property that is next to the Red Barn there. If you were to drive up Thanes Canyon Drive there and, like, along Three Kings Drive, it's next to the Red Barn, but it does not include the Red Barn. Is that property also protected?
That property is not protected at this point. What we're talking about is the pasture property because it's two different sides of the Armstrong family. I've known Carrie and Mel for over two decades. And, of course, you know, Mel has passed away. But as we've had discussions with Carrie, she has said, you know, this is something that she and now have always wanted. They've always had a conservation ethic. And then Herb Armstrong is the owner of the other 50%. and he is committed to the conservation as well. And then, of course, Herb and Shelley's son, Dustin, has been at the table throughout these conversations. So, you know, we're talking about just the pastures, and part of it is you have two families, not just one family. And we really need to make sure we protect the pastures if we're going to talk about any other preservation. So right now we're dealing with both Armstrong families, and we feel incredibly fortunate that both families are committed to finding a conservation solution for the pastures.
So Utah Open Lands did a survey months ago asking people if they could get behind it. Was there widespread support for that, or was it really just support from the Thames Canyon area?
You know, we sensed widespread support, and then also there was a Deseret News article just the other day when we sent out the press release, and I was really surprised looking at the comments how many people were talking about how important it is to protect some of these remaining open spaces. I think this is one of the larger open spaces within the city limits. So we think that there is widespread support for this.
Right. And we're down to, what, a $6 million campaign? I'm sure the property, if you were to just turn around and sell it today, would be worth a lot more than that.
Yeah, probably close to $17 million.
So how were you able to knock it down?
You know, that really, I have to give all of the credit to the family. They recognize that any sort of fundraising campaign is tough. Both families have been a part of this community for, you know, decades. I mean, they know how important these sort of legacy pieces are to the community. We're all getting older, myself included, and so they're looking at future choices. They couldn't donate the entire thing. But, I mean, we're talking about two-thirds of the value of the conservation easement being donated because these families are as committed to preserving it as Utah Open Lands is.
So how will the family, if in fact we do buy that conservation easement, how will the family be able to use the property?
So there will be absolutely no development. So no structures at all will ever impede that viewshed, which I think is huge. There's also obviously the wildlife habitat that is there, but they will be able to continue to graze cattle on it in much the way that has happened since, you know, it was a dairy farm back in the 20s. So that will continue. And then, you know, we've even talked about the fact that there is city-owned property up above the pasture piece. And they've even said, you know, yeah, we'd be willing to talk about potentially providing a trail access to that property, if that makes sense.
Okay, and that's what I was going to ask. So conservation easements don't necessarily allow public access unless you can work that out, huh?
Well, and I think that this is something that we keep talking about, and this is a challenge for protecting agricultural land. In fact, when I was there at the very beginning of the Mountain Trails Foundation, one of our big messages to people using trails was you got to close gates and you got to make sure that your dogs don't chase the livestock. So when you're talking about protecting an agricultural piece of property, it is really hard to also include that any sort of public access. So, yeah, primarily what we want to do is we want to preserve this agricultural and scenic and wildlife value of this property.
So $6 million, where does that come from? Everybody's pocketbook?
Yes, everybody's pocketbook, for sure. We need donors to step forward if this is what they think should be protected. We'd like to hear from them. We will not be able to do this alone. There's no question about that. This is a unique opportunity. We've been talking about this for a long time, and then Bonanza happened. And so we had to shift our focus and our attention to that. There's always going to be an open space or a need out there. This was the time that we had to be able to move forward with this, and we really hope that people step forward and help us do this because we need contributions to make it happen.
Are there any opportunities for matching grants with this?
We are working on that right now. We hope to be back with you in the next week or so. We've been talking to some different foundations and donors. So we are hoping that there will be some matching funds that we can come up with. 100% of the contributions that are going to be made are going to all go to the purchase of the conservation easement. And if we're not successful, yeah, people will get their money back.
How do people contribute?
they can go to utahopenlands.org, and the first thing that's going to pop up is donate to Snow Ranch Pastures.
All right. Real quick, Wendy, can you talk a little bit about how things work between Utah Open Lands and Summit Land Conservancy? You've got the Snow Ranch Pastures, Summit Land Conservancy working on the Oscarthorpe property. I mean, what do you flip a coin to decide who's taking on what?
I wish it were that easy. I think that the reality of it is that a lot of these things happen based on long-time relationships. And, of course, Utah Open Land started in 1990 right there in Park City on Prospector Avenue. And the Armstrong property was one of those properties, just like High Ute, that we focused on at the very beginning, saying, wouldn't it be great if we could protect this? You know, back then we had a lot of growth happening, and we didn't even have the sophistication of some of the planning and some of the tools. We certainly, at that point, didn't have any bonds. And I know for the Summit Land Conservancy, they've had a tremendous relationship with the Oscarthorpe family. So, you know, these are not easy decisions because, as you said at the beginning of the interview, you know, you could turn around and you could sell this property for $17 million plus. And once it gets in the hands of the developer, we all know what the end of that story is. So what do we look at, and I know that the Summit Land Conservancy looks at it as well, is how do you translate these trusting relationships into permanent, forever preservation of these amazing open space jewels that we have that are really dotted throughout our community and that really improve the quality of life. And so, you know, I applaud the work that the Summit Land Conservancy has done with the Oscarthorpe and the funds that they have raised. And I know that they've had a relationship with that family for a long time. And as I said, we've had a relationship with the Armstrongs for a very long time. And sometimes that's what it takes to make sure that we can protect these vital pieces of our quality of life. There's just no question that when people come to Park City, they don't want to see condos. They'd rather see cows.
Yeah. How does that sit with the real estate community? I mean, I know many realtors who are big donors of open space, but at the same time, it's kind of, you know, just taken houses to sell off their plate.
You know, I think that we'll never run out of some of these different growth opportunities. And the thing that I think is really amazing about the Park City real estate community, and we've seen it from the very beginning, when Utah Open Land started in Summit County, all of our board members that were on board were all residents in the Summit County area. And 85% of them were real estate or developers, real estate agents or developers. And so what they saw is they didn't want to kill the goose that laid the golden egg. And that's what I've seen over and over and over again, is the real estate community making grants to nonprofits, the real estate community making grants to some of these open space projects, because they recognize that what maintains the market value is really the protection, again, of that quality of life, which emanates from the open spaces. So I've always been impressed. I don't think you see that in the rest of the state. I know you don't. I mean, we've worked statewide, and I know that you don't see that in the rest of the state. So we have a unique community with a unique sense of community and with a unique sense of what is really valuable. And I've seen that over and over again. So I applaud the real estate community. I mean, they're really a big part of the reason why Utah Open Lands got started.
All right. Wendy, anything else you wanted to mention?
No, just if you know of anybody who is interested in helping us preserve this, please give us a call. You can contact myself or Marie, so you can go to utahopenlands.org or call us at 801-463-6156.
Okay, Wendy Fisher, Executive Director of Utah Open Lands. Thanks for your time this morning.
Hey, thank you, Leslie.